Reminded ourselves about explicit representations of the momentum operator. And now we're going to do the same thing for to work out how these Q and Q bar operators are explicitly represented in terms of the superspace coordinates. So we consider a super Poincaré transformation, a particular set of them. And okay, I'm going to leave the indices off these coordinates just so that the brevity. But this thing, we consider going to some parameters epsilon times the explicit representation of epsilon bar. So this is just like acting with e to the I or a mu p mu on the field. Okay, and we know that this is going to move us about in superspace, just like we did for the translation operator. And in fact, it's going to move us not only in the theta and theta bar coordinates, but it's going to move us in x coordinates as well. Okay, so in general, I mean, the change in the x coordinate, if we want to write something down that's linear in the epsilons and epsilon bars, is real because these coordinates are real and has the right indices, then we must write something like this. So C is just a complex constant. And that's all we can write. So we have to have C star here because of the reality condition. It's got to have transform like a vector under the Lorentz group. And that's why there's a mu here. But aside from that, it should have no spinner indices left over. And so we've contracted them up. Yes. Yeah, thanks. Thank you. We're going to derive a constraint on it. Yeah.
Going back to the question from this morning, those these are complex constants.
Yeah, they are. They're complex coordinates. Which, right. Yeah, that's right. Yes, thank you. I'd forgotten about that. Okay, so all you do, actually, all we do now is we we expand out. We Taylor expand this right-hand side and expand the left-hand side to first order in epsilon and epsilon bar. And then you just equate the coefficients between epsilons on the left and the right. Doing that. And that gives us our Qs. And Q bars. C star P theta and beta sigma mu beta alpha dot d mu. Okay, so that's just from expanding out these two things. And remember, our explicit representation on a field of the momentum operator we saw this morning is minus I d mu. Okay, so, and we know, you know, through the identification with our more abstract field operators, that we want this to give us QQ bar anticommutator is 2 sigma mu out P times P mu. Okay, so if we put the explicit representations on the fields down, it should satisfy this equation. And so star, if we write star in terms of Q's, the curly Q's and curly P, we get that the right hand side looks like so we get that it's equal to 2. So we just substitute in our expressions for the curly Q's 1 and 2 into this. Calculate the anticommutators. And you get something with basically only the cross terms give you anything. So d by d theta alpha times this gives you a, you know, some minus I d mu, which is going to look like the curly P. And the other cross term gives you the other thing with the C star. And so we get the real part of C times the curly mu. So the curly P operator. So if we want this to match up with star, we want the real part of C to be 1. And in fact, we just set, ignore the imaginary bit, and set C equals 1. So it's consistent. So, yeah, that's fine. So our change in our superfield, generic superfield, is to first order is I, just from expanding out this exponential, I epsilon times Q plus epsilon bar Q bar times S. And what we can do is write out the change in the superfield as a change in all the components. Remember, before we wrote it down, the superfield is, in fact, it'd be useful to have it up here. So I'll write it again. Phi plus theta psi plus theta bar chi bar plus theta bar n plus theta sigma mu theta bar v mu plus theta theta bar lambda bar plus theta bar theta rho plus theta bar theta bar times d. Okay, where each of these things that aren't thetas or theta bars or sigmas are fields on the right hand side. So, you know, delta s, we can change all the fields on the right hand side. So delta s is just delta phi plus theta delta psi, etc. Okay. And so all we do is we equate delta s in terms of the component fields with the right hand side, where we substitute one and 2 into the right-hand side of the equation in terms of the differential operators. And it's a tutorial for tomorrow to calculate what the change in all the fields looks like in the component fields. And if you do that correctly, this is what you should get. So the change in the scalar field should just be epsilon psi plus epsilon bar psi bar. So this is under a supersymmetry transformation. Change in the fermionic field is 2 epsilon m plus sigma mu epsilon bar v mu plus I sigma mu epsilon bar d mu phi. So if you try and do all of this in one go, it's a bit horrendous. But if you just break it up into the individual bits, it's not too bad. There's a few lines for each one of these. And you have to do a little bit of manipulation to get them in this form. A bit of manipulation with the spinners. You use some of the relations between spinners that you've derived, Fiat's identities and so on. So what we should be seeing as I write these down is that the change in a field, so if we've got a bosonic field on the left, the change in the field involves fermions on the right, and vice versa. So we can see explicitly that fermions are changing into bosons, as previously advertised, and vice versa. Of course, this is an infinitesimal transformation, sigma bar nu, sigma nu, nu chi bar. So if you spot any differences, are there any differences with signs in Fernando's notes so far?
You're missing the M term in the expression of S.
Thank you. Okay, so we have all of these changes of the field components. So the comments are bosons are changing in a gradual way into fermions and vice versa in every case. And something we're going to use later is the change in this D field is a total derivative. So I just want you to note that for now. So there's a bit of algebra to do to satisfy yourselves that that is indeed the case. So let me make some remarks on superfields now. So if S1 and S2 are superfields, then the product of them is also a superfield. Since the change under a supersymmetry transformation of S1, S2 is, of course, S1 delta S2 plus delta S1 times S2, which is S1 times epsilon q plus epsilon bar q bar. Oh, am I? This is a vector index row.
Oh, I see.
Sorry, yeah, it's a bit confusing.
Is
yeah, I could use it as a different index here. Okay. Yeah, no, it's a good, that's a good point. We're sort of running out of sheet metals. Okay, so the change in superfield 2 is just equal to this times superfield 2, and the change in superfield 1 is that times superfield 1, acting on superfield 1 only. Thank you. Thank you. I don't know why I'm forgetting those. Okay, and then because, you know, Q and Q bar are differential operators, the Leibniz property is just that this is equal to I times that acting on S1, S2. So it's just the product rule. Okay, so anything that transforms in this way, where you put something in this bracket on the right-hand side, is a superfield, as we showed before. We already know d mu s is a superfield, because it's also going to... d mu commutes with these q's, and so it's going to transform in that way. But d alpha s, which is defined as d by d theta alpha of s, is not a superfield. And that's essentially because d alpha doesn't commute with the q's. So if we take delta of d alpha s, which is d alpha of delta s, so this is d alpha acting on epsilon q plus epsilon bar q bar of s. Okay, this thing is not, because d alpha just doesn't commute through the q's, you can calculate the commutator. This thing is not equal to that, which it would have to be if d alpha s was a superfield. So there's an obvious thing here. Obviously we want to define a covariant derivative that's going to have the right transformation properties. Actually commutes with epsilon times Q. In other words, anti-commute with Q. So actually it's pretty easy to define those. Hence, define this D alpha, capital D, which is D by D theta alpha plus I sigma mu alpha dot theta bar alpha dot D mu. And D bar alpha dot minus D by D theta bar alpha dot minus I theta alpha sigma mu alpha dot D mu. Okay, so you can just calculate some anti-commutators yourselves. Pretty easy. If you take the anti-commutator of these two things, you get something very reminiscent of the anti-commutator of the Q's. Curly P. This should be a curly P. Actually, it has the main things we're interested in is that it anti-commutes with the Q bars and the Qs. So all of those anti-commutators are zero. So it commutes with epsilon q plus epsilon bar q bar. Because the epsilons are Grassmann valued, it's going to commute. So big D alpha acting on S is a superfield. All right. So actually, we've written down this generic superfield here. But it's got more components than we have to have. We can actually write down some subset of those components, those terms on the right-hand side, and still have consistent superfields. But there are constraints on it. For instance, if we just write the first term, so if we wrote just S as a scalar field, that's a superfield only if that scalar field is actually a constant. In other words, not a real quantum field at all. Some constant through space. Because otherwise, we can use our Suzy transformations. We can do a transformation on this thing, and even though we start with no fermionic component, we'll generate one from the supersymmetry transformation because it's going to look like that, d mu phi. Okay, so we do a Suzy transformation, we start to generate this fermionic component. So we can see that just the scalar, unless it's a constant on its own, isn't going to transform into itself under a supersymmetry representation. By the same token, you can't just write down the fermionic component. Since then, you get some change in the scalar part of the field, which would start to be non-zero. So obviously, the fermionic and the scalar bits of the field come together, go together. But S is a reducible representation, so we can write down smaller versions of it that are consistent with the SUSY transformations. We can eliminate some components. And keep it a superfield. And so there are several examples. One of them is a chiral superfield. Chiral superfield. This is defined such that d bar alpha acting on the superfield is zero. So, yeah, okay. There's an anti-chiral superfield, which is defined such that d alpha acting on it is zero. There's a vector superfield where it's equal to its Hermitian conjugate. And there's a linear superfield where it's actually a subset of the vector superfields. So we have S equals S dagger and D times D times S is zero. And there's some, when you impose these constraints on the superfields, there are some rough conventions that are used. Chiral superfields, actually, instead of writing them in terms of this general 1s, they're usually written as phi's. And the anti-chiral ones, you'll often see written as phi bar. Vector ones, you'll see written as v. And the linear ones as l. Okay, but yeah, it's just a notational thing. Yeah.
Since the bosonic derivative commutes with the supersymmetry transformation, is it sensible to have a constraint using just the bosonic derivatives?
Well, it's no, because remember we have this, right? So, well, okay. Let me see. The thing is, if we, you know, d mu s is d mu phi plus some other terms, okay, with some d mu's in. I can just define this as phi prime, right? This is another scale of, vector field, yeah. It's a vector field, so it transforms into some other bit of the thing. Okay. So chiral superfields are the ones where we put quarks and leptons. They're massless representations of the n equals 1 supersymmetry. So they're the ones that are useful for phenomenology. They can be complex representations of the gauge group as well. But they are complex in general. So what we're going to do is do a change of coordinates because it makes the algebra simpler. And then we'll get back to ordinary coordinates. So I just want to show you, this chiral superfield has this constraint applied to it, and it's going to involve some subset of these component fields on the right-hand side, and I'm going to derive those now by defining this weird coordinate y mu, which is just x mu plus I theta sigma mu theta bar, like that. Okay. So if I have some chiral superfield phi, which is a function of y theta and theta bar, then since d bar alpha dot is a differential operator, we can use the chain rule. So d bar alpha dot on phi, which is a function of y theta and theta bar, is d bar So we just use the chain rule on the coordinates. Sorry, thanks. So d bar acting on phi, we can just write in terms of those three terms. And from the constraint of a chiral superfield, this thing, if phi is a chiral superfield, this thing had better be equal to zero. Okay, so if you look at our explicit expressions for d bar, when it acts on theta, that gives you a zero. This second term, d bar alpha dot acting on y mu, is just minus d alpha dot bar minus I theta alpha sigma rho alpha alpha dot d rho acting on y, which is x mu plus I theta sigma mu theta bar. This thing is equal to I theta alpha you go through the algebra, you get zero as well. So, and then when you look at this, the thing in this bracket, that's non-zero, okay? And so what we have is that phi had better not depend on any theta bar coordinates. So we know, we can see already, which terms we're going to throw away. It's all the ones with theta bars in. So we have a scalar component. We have a theta times phi component. Now, there's just a convention that where you rescale this phi by a root 2 chiral superfields. Okay, it's just a scaling convention. You get a lot of root 2s coming in later and it gets rid of some of them. And the other term we have is this last one where M is some scalar field. And that's just, for, I don't know why, but it's usually written as F when you go to the chiral superfield. But it's just some scalar field which comes from this last term. So now what we can do, we want to get back to what this field, superfield looks like in X coordinates. So we just expand into X coordinates. So all right, so I wonder how much of this to do. I can show you how it goes. So, of course, we expand y mu around x mu. So that's the second order term expansion of this phi of y mu. And the third order one has three powers of theta in it. So it's zero through anti-symmetry. So we don't have to go any further. And we go on to the psi fields. So again, that's the last order term we need to consider because we'll get three powers of theta in any further terms because there's a theta at the front. And there's the only one term in the expansion of this x of the f. So all of these x's should and the y's, strictly speaking, have mu's on them. Mu, 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 mu. So it looks like it looks very simple in these y coordinates and a bit of a dog's dinner in the x coordinates. So I can rewrite these terms using some of our relations. Okay, I'm going to miss the mu's off because I can't be bothered writing them all. So I can rewrite this term as minus a quarter theta theta, theta bar, box times phi. So that's just a sort of canonical way of writing it. And so it will be another exercise during a tutorial just to check how these components, or possibly could be anyway, an exercise see how the components transform. I mean, once you've done it for the general superfield, you actually can just map it because you know how the individual components transform. And so you just get written in terms of these new fields. We have the root 2 normalization factor comes into the variation of phi. The variation of the fermion gives us this. So I'm suppressing spinner indices here. And the change in the F scalar field is I root 2 epsilon bar sigma bar mu d mu psi. So things to notice, again, you know, fermions and bosons are transforming into each other. This change in this F field is a total derivative. Again. And what we notice is we started off with phis, psis, and Fs, okay, and we do a Suzy transformation, and we don't generate any new components of the fields. Yeah. Yeah. So you can work it out. I'll teach you how to work it out. It's for more useful, right? So you know that theta and theta bar are Grassmann valued, right? So you know you've got to make all of these terms as a whole have the same either Grassmann or non-Grassmann value. And we know that this the thing to remember is this first one is a scalar field, right? So now we have some Grassmann-valued thing. So this one's got to be Grassmann-valued, okay? Same for this chi-bar. That's a fermionic field. But now we have the product of two Grassmann-valued things, which overall is just bosonic. So it's got to end up being bosonic, so this thing had better be bosonic as well. It's just a scalar field. V mu, well, obviously that's a vector. It's got a mu index. And, you know, this lambda bar, again, that's bosonic. This is fermionic. So two fermions multiplied together again make a boson, so that's got to be fermionic. That's fermionic, the rho, by the same token. This is scalar, and that's scalar. So you can tell, well, either by considering that it's in a contraction with another spinner. So, I mean, if I'd written all the indices, in, it'd look horrendous. But you could tell just from the fact there's an alpha dot on it, obviously. Yeah, so what I was saying here was we started with just phi, psi, and f. And we do a Suzy transformation. And all we see is that the, you know, we end up with just phi, changes in phi, psi, and f. So obviously that's a consistent transformation. It's just transforming among it and themselves, these components. The f.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So this is just a renaming of the m. It's a convention that when you do a... I mean, I could have written just f here. It's just a scalar field, and it was used to be the m. I don't know why the convention is to write it as M there.
The rho also gets projected out, but it's a fermion. What would be the spin of that object before it's projected out? It's a spin half, or?
Yeah, it's still spin half. It's a spin half left-handed spinner. But, you know, it's just got some theta bars out the front, so it goes away. Okay, so, right. That's good. Right, so the we can ask now how if we've got a couple of chiral superfields, what about the product of them? Is that chiral? Well, it is. Product of two chiral superfields is chiral, since if we take the d bar alpha dot of S1, S2, okay, this thing is zero if S1 and S2 are chiral superfields, because each of these brackets is zero. On the other hand, you know, d bar of S1 dagger is non-zero. Because, you know, you'll start getting some theta bars in there. And so you're not allowed to, we can start iterating this and write down any polynomial in chiral superfields, and that will also be a chiral superfield, right? But it has to be holomorphic. So you might wonder why I'm bothering about defining this. But actually, one of the ways that we're going to write down our manifestly supersymmetric Lagrangian involves identifying a chiral superfield that can be the product of all the individual ones you've got. So this will come in handy, these facts. So the other thing, which is pretty easy to work out, is that if S1 is chiral, then actually S1 dagger is anti-chiral. Okay, that's the definition of an anti-chiral field. So I should say d bar alpha dot of S1 is zero, implies that d alpha of S1 dagger is zero, and therefore S1 dagger is a chiral, anti-chiral superfield. Anti-chiral. On the other hand, if we've got some chiral superfield phi, if phi is chiral superfield, phi dagger, phi, and, for example, phi dagger plus phi, things like that are real superfields, not chiral or anti-chiral. That's good. So, you know, and an example of a real superfield is a vector superfield, which we're going to do next lecture. And so what's going to happen is that all of the matter, quarks, leptons, neutrinos, all that stuff, is going to go into chiral superfields, actually. But the gauge bosons and their spin half partners are going to go into these vector superfields. So this is why we're spending a lot of time on these two kinds of superfield. Okay, any more questions?